I'm out here early in the morning, in the dark, on a public Wi-Fi. There's no way anybody's gonna do anything that could affect my computer, right? Hey guys, and welcome to the show. I am up early. It is not even 6 a.m. yet. I'm out in downtown Pasadena. And so what you see is what you get. It's dark out here. There are a lot of noises, so be prepared. I think there's a street sweeper coming up. This is going to be an interesting episode. With me today, I have Jessica Payne. Jessica, how's it going?
It's good. I'm not about to be mugged, so I think I'm better than you.
Yeah. Well, it's early where you are, too, from what I understand. You're in Western Canada.
I'm in Calgary this week, so live from a Calgary hotel room is where I am.
Woohoo!
I have a fancy Canadian work permit, though, which is nice, because normally I get stuck at the border, so.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I've had to go through that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how long are you in Canada for?
Just till Friday. So we're doing a slam engagement, which you might remember from another fine taste of premiere video we did. So it should be fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Is Neil with you?
No. He's at an incident response this week. So the Microsoft, I believe, are called the Global Incident Response and Recovery Team, also known as GIR, is set to three different places in the globe right now. But I lucked out and got Canada.
So I have a funny Neil story real quick. I was walking through the Charlotte Douglas Airport about 2 weeks ago, and I looked up, and there's Billy Corgan from Smashing Pumpkins.
Wow.
Walking towards me, and I know it's him, right, because I didn't talk to him or anything, but he's got the black Chicago Bulls hat on with the white Bulls emblem, right, and on his backpack he's got an I Love Cheap Trick button, which is like a dead giveaway because he's a huge Cheap Trick fan. And take a few more steps, and there's Neil at the shoe shine place getting his shoes shined. And so I talk to him for a few minutes and go on my way. Well, later I post on Facebook, hey, I saw Billy Corgan in the Charlotte airport. And immediately Neil comes back and says, well, that's nice, but you saw me too, and you didn't mention that.
That's funny. It's funny. You can always count on seeing a Microsoft person at an airport. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty cool. So today you're going to talk to us about ransomware.
Yeah, so it's funny because when I said I was going to talk about ransomware with you, another person on my team said, that's old hat, everybody knows about that, why would you talk about that? And that's very true from a malware researcher perspective or a security person's perspective, but you know, I still visit really high maturity level IT organizations that are plagued by this problem. So I think we need to talk about it a little bit more because it really does relate to security landscape in general and how you can be infected with very targeted things just by how you can get ransomware. So, you know, ransomware, you may be familiar with it being called CryptoLocker. It's where you get that little flash pop-up and it says, hey, I've encrypted your files. You have to pay me to get them back. But, you know, we're seeing organizations with massive IT budgets, massive IT staff, and, you know, otherwise you would think, wow, this place really has its life together. And they're still having problems with ransomware because it's not, I think, well understood how the malware vector is getting on there. So that's kind of what I wanted to talk about today, as well as, you know, strategies for preventing it and strategies for how to react when you do get a malware case, because I think that there are a lot of avenues available to Premier customers that they're not aware of, and I wanted to talk about those today.
Yeah, and I think that's awesome because, you know, I think a lot of people, when they hear, you know, the CryptoLocker ransomware thing, you know, they think, oh, that's a grandma issue. That's something that's going to happen to my grandmother because she's not careful about where she goes on the internet. And that's not really necessarily the case.
It's a grandma issue, and actually we've seen some cases where they're specifically targeting grandmas because there's sick people, and not the grandmas, the bad guys. And they're doing things like targeting obituary website advertisement servers in order to specifically target the elderly because they expect that they'll pay. So it's really sad, but it's also affecting corporations too. I mean, when we talk about premier support customers, these are not mom and pop shops. These are places that have an IT budget that can afford to, you know, pay for the quality support that we give them. And we've actually seen, you know, out of all the ransomware cases we've seen, we've actually had a company go out of business because they didn't have a backup strategy that was appropriate for ransomware. So it's it's not just mom. It's not just, you know, the home user that's being affected by this. This is something that is making it into corporations. And it's really indicative of a larger hole in a security strategy, because the same exact vector that you would get to get the CryptoLocker ransomware is the same thing that you would get to get a targeted attack. So addressing the issue that's leading to this commodity, you know, kind of just nuisance malware is very important, because it's the exact same thing that's going to get you on the front page of the news eventually. It's going to be that type of vulnerability.
Yeah, absolutely. So I hear you've got a great presentation for us.
I don't know about great presentation, but there's cat pictures in it. So ransomware takes a lot of different forms. You know, normally when we think about it, you know, somebody's encrypted your files, they're not available for you to view, you get some sort of pop-up that indicates that you need to pay them, and that's normally the typical behavior of it. So this is what people are used to seeing with ransomware. My actual favorite ransomware, and it actually came out around Christmas, so it might be it was charitable spirit, but they would allow you to decrypt one file for free. So that was actually my favorite kind of ransomware. But, you know, what you see is you see these things come down. They've got that decrypt instruction. You can't access your files anymore. And the way that this works is it's quite often, you know, what has happened is it's actually run an encryption algorithm against your files in the context of the currently logged on user. You don't need administrative access to do this. As a matter of fact, Kurt Falde shared with me a way to do this with PowerShell. So as a non-administrative user, just with access to the files, using a PowerShell script, you would be able to do ransomware, CryptoLocker ransomware type behavior against all of the files on your computer and all of the files on any file server that you have access to. And that's where this becomes very dangerous for businesses, because if you have a mapped drive, this is going to crawl through all of those and encrypt them. And it's either going to do it through something like a built-in API in Windows, which makes it very hard to kind of detect and prevent against, because it's just you messing with your files, or we've seen some variations using OpenSSL and different open source cryptography, but each individual file is going to be encrypted with its own AES-256 encryption key, essentially, so it's not something you're going to break into. And it is just running in the context of the user. So oftentimes you don't even need a vulnerability to do this. You'll either convince somebody to do it through a phishing message, or, you know, it'll just run in the context of the user. So a regular old user with no administrative rights in a company, that if the mapped drives that they have are something like the file server that holds all of the files for the company, and they have read access to that, or I'm sorry, edit access to that, that company's going down. And
I want to ask you real quick. So it sounds like somebody could just send you an email with, you know, hey, you need to change your password on eBay, mm-hmm. or something like that, that has a link that looks like it's eBay unless you hover over it. And when you click on it, that could launch a PowerShell script that could encrypt your files.
Yeah, I actually have a screenshot of a way to get that launched. And again, it's something that I've seen used in a targeted attack as well. But absolutely, that's how it is. If somebody will, you know, send you something that looks like a receipt, or they'll send you, you know, something very, very targeted, or really, one of the ways that we're seeing this be delivered is through exploit kit. And exploit kits are embedded into legitimate web pages often via the advertising networks. So the very first week I worked at Microsoft, it was a very exciting week. I was locked in an office for 14 hours a day with Andrew Davis studying ransomware because we'd had a massive outbreak of ransomware cases, and nobody could figure out where they were coming from because they couldn't see, you know, the telltale signs of being in Outlook, opening up an email, things like that. And I said, hey, Andrew, have you heard of exploit kits? So we dug in and we found out that it's actually coming from people just visiting legitimate news sites and the advertising server that had been running like buy toilet paper or whatever ads on the right hand side had actually been infected. And just from visiting a legitimate news site, these people were getting ransomware. And that's a really important thing to know, because it's not always, you know, users doing dumb things here. It's just visiting, you know, websites they might go to throughout their daily business that can lead to this malware.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, the other thing is that this malware is usually very, very backup aware. So it always, almost always, disables the volume shadow copy service. So that's what you can use in Windows to do built-in backups. So like previous versions, that tab that's there when you view a file, that's based on the volume shadow copy service. So it'll stop the volume shadow copy service. It'll do its business and edit the files, and then it'll start up the volume shadow copy service again, meaning you can't restore your files because they're seen as being different files. So that's how this has really, really hit businesses that don't have a redundant backup strategy or a different way to back these things up, because it stops volume shadow copy service and everything's gone. So that's that's scary. And we've actually seen a couple samples that have APIs for getting rid of your shadow copies in OneDrive and Dropbox too. So, you know, understanding where you're backing up and how to back up, and knowing that it's running in the context of the user, it has the rights to do anything the user can do. So if there's an API that a user can call to delete all of their shadow copies, it's going to be able to do that. So that's how this has had really, really catastrophic effects on businesses.
Wow. So it sounds like it's pretty easy to get infected with this.
Yes.
It's incredibly destructive. Mm-hmm. How do we prevent it?
Well, we can prevent it in a couple different ways. I did want to kind of make one little point, though, is that there's a reason they're trying so hard to get this ransomware onto machines. When they took down the first CryptoLocker server, like the command and control server for it, they found out that only 1.3% of the people that were hit by the malware ever paid the ransom. The rest just formatted and started over. Even though they only had that rate of response, they made $3 million. So this is one of those, you know, if I can get malware on your box, I can make money off of you type of things. So this is a really, really motivated business that goes on here.
Wow.
Yeah, and last year, 27% of the premier security cases that we had were ransomware. So this is, you know, rampant. And the reason I bring up that 27% thing is that almost all of those were caused by out-of-date third-party software on those systems, Flash or Java. They visited a web page that had been infected with an exploit kit. They had out-of-date Java because of a mission-critical application, and they got ransomware. So everything we talked about, you know, in the last couple of videos or any of the security stuff that you're seeing, if you've got out-of-date Java and that's causing you to get ransomware, that also means that targeted attacks are going to work against you too. So 27% of our security cases, those customers were vulnerable to targeted attacks as well as this commodity ransomware thing. So that's a very scary number. So you asked about how the malware can get on the system. So phishing, you know, this is the same thing that you would see with a targeted attack or with this commodity malware. And this is a huge vector. A lot of what we saw last year was this. It's going to be either an enticing or a scary email with an attachment. And that attachment is often executable, even if it doesn't look like it. You'll see something that looks like an image or, you know, maybe some sort of file, but it's actually a .scr file, or you'll get a zip file that contains a .scr file. File is a screensaver file, which is an executable. Or it'll come in through a PDF, and the PDF will have a vulnerability. But it's sad. A lot of times, it is just a zip file that someone double-clicks on, and it executes, and it installs the malware for them. So, and, you know, especially when we consider ransomware, because it doesn't have to have administrative access to do it. So here's a couple little examples that I grabbed off of the MMPC blog, so you can see that they're trying to scare people or entice them with money. And then this is actually my favorite current malware vector, because this is a this is kind of unrelated to ransomware. This was from a different threat, but you'll get a Word document and it'll tell you that you can't see a pretty picture, or you have incorrect encoding, or some sort of reason to make you want to click on it and enable macros. Now, macros have been disabled in Office products for a very long time, because what a macro is it's a command prompt running out of your Office document. So we've had those disabled by default for a very, very long time. But it turns out that if you make it look like there's going to be a pretty picture of something attractive, or maybe an enticing way to get free money, people will happily click that button. And when they click that button, it will run scripts. It'll do anything you want. I've actually seen it running PowerShell-based malware to do credential theft, so targeted malware for this exact same way. So if you have users who are able to click on that button, if it's not 100% disabled across the board by policy, they're going to be able to execute code in your environment. So this one's especially scary because this isn't, you know, a vulnerability per se. Somebody could be clicking OK on that run macros and running that PowerShell version of ransomware that I talked about earlier. That's very scary. So phishing.
Wow. So somebody sends me a picture of you.
No, it'd be like, so we've actually, it's weird, and you have to kind of hedge how you're talking about it, because there have been some targeted attacks specifically in Asia where it comes in like a document like this, and instead of where it says you have the wrong encoding, it's a blurry picture of what is clearly an attractive female. And they tell people that they have to click on it to unblur and view the attractive female, and people do it. So email hygiene is a big part of this, you know, email hygiene and, you know, group policies to make sure that we're absolutely disabling the macros. There's a lot of places still that aren't really doing, you know, deep dive blocking of zip files, doing PE header scanning, or places that aren't taking advantage if they're Office 365 customers. There's some cool stuff we have with the advanced, I think it's called advanced threat protection now, but it's a detonation chamber. So it can take your attachment and actually see what's going on in there. So if you're an Office 365 customer, there's a few more things that you can enable, you know, add on to what you're doing with Office 365 that would take, you know, a document and take that zip file that's executable, run it, and say, no, that's not coming into your environment. So email hygiene is a big part of this, as well as user training, because one of the places that had the problem with a macro doing bad stuff in the environment, they had to allow macros because they had some mission critical forms that did it. So it's really kind of an IT organization education point as well as a user education point. If you are training your users to do things that can lead to compromise every single day, of course they're going to go ahead and do it. So this is something, you know, reach out to your TAM, reach out to your Microsoft person. We can talk to you about different ways that you might be able to do this in your environment, maybe converting it to a web form. And then you can kind of, you know, authoritatively lock it down. And then the same stuff with the email hygiene stuff is there's a lot more that you can do inside of EOP, especially if you're an Office 365 customer that maybe you're not taking advantage of right now. So, but phishing, the social engineering aspect, it's awful because it's so often the way that things get in there because it's just so easy.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's crazy. So I had no idea. I thought probably like a lot of the people viewing this that, you know, somehow somebody injected, you know, a piece of code or infected you with a virus and that's how this happened. It sounds like this can happen to anybody. Hang on.
Live from Pasadena.
Bus going by. It sounds like this can happen to anybody without really any malware installed, just because they've run a macro or clicked on something that looks completely innocuous to them.
And that's really the case with a lot of user-based malware. There's even some targeted attacks that are just entirely user context-based. And, you know, it's not that you have to have admin access. It's not that you have to install that service, although certainly that's definitely something that a lot of malware is doing. But if it can run in your context and you let it run, it's going to run. So even things like keyloggers, stuff like that, can happen, you know, just in a user context. So this is, in a lot of ways, you know, sort of, I don't want to say next generation because it's old, but this is really something to watch out for because these are the ways that you'll be able to evade detection in a lot of environments. You know, again, you know, high maturity level environments that might be looking for certain things. You know, if I can run in the user context, I might miss it because it's not something like a service or something that's there. And that's why a lot of times the customers who call us who've had the ransomware outbreaks, they're like, my end users don't have admin access. How did this happen to me? I've done everything right. And no, your end users didn't have admin access. But because it was running in the context of them against files that they have access to, it totally did what it needed to do. And that's a scary thing that people need to be aware of.
That's a good question, actually. Do most of these ransomware components attack specific files, like one file at a time, or do they encrypt entire drives?
They don't encrypt entire drives most of the time. Most of the time they look at the extension of the document, and they encrypt, you know, things like PDF, Word documents, things like that. But by the time that you've noticed it's done, and actually I have a screenshot of some of the forensic stuff we look at, you know it's done because it drops a decrypt instruction.html. It doesn't do that until it's done. So it even makes detection difficult because it'll be crawling through your hard drive, touching PDFs and .docs and .jpegs and things that you have access to. And it's you touching your files, which makes it kind of hard to detect. So that's where a lot of people are like, hey, why didn't System Center Endpoint Protection, or why didn't antivirus vendor that I have, other antivirus vendor detect this? And that's because it's not really the problem to detect it, because it would have to detect an end user touching their own files. And a lot of our detection capabilities with it, if it's not signature-based, the behavioral-based ones are based on, hey, did you touch 5,000 files in like 30 seconds? Because then it probably wasn't you. But asking for a detection on it is oftentimes the wrong way to think about it, because that's, you know, as Andrew says, I've got a hole in my castle wall and I'm asking my archers to aim better versus patching the hole. So that's really how we'd like to look at it, as we'd like to be able to block that vector coming in. Because it is one of those things that you don't notice until it's done.
Yeah. So if I'm on a machine that has multiple users, it's highly likely that the user that's logged in is the one that's going to get their files encrypted, but another user who isn't logged in, and by the way, I don't have access to their user directory, is probably still safe.
Yeah, it depends, though. We've actually seen some, you know, multi-user terminal server type environments where people have had their C drives automatically mapped to it through the connector that was getting them into that terminal server. And so, therefore, the way that it was mapped, one person got drive-by ransomware from a web page, and everyone's C drives got infected. So that was cool.
Yeah.
So it all depends, actually, and you know it's not necessarily as cut and dry as that. But yeah, if it was a user directory that somebody didn't have access to, that one would probably evade.
Awesome.
Okay. So the other scary way that you can get it is exploit kits. So exploit kits are a really big business right now, because simply visiting a web page is enough to get infected. And it's often embedded into advertisements on legitimate web pages. So the delivery mechanism here is a malicious.swf, that's a flash file, or a malicious.jar, which is a Java file. And Andrew Davis calls these the Rolodex of evil, because you visit a web page, it figures out exactly which, it contacts the exploit kit web page, because it's going to be a landing page, figures out exactly which thing you're vulnerable to, because it's not just tossing every, you know, type of malware in the book at you. It says, ah, you have flash that's exactly 3 weeks old. I have a package for you, because it's going to target specifically the vulnerability on your machine. We've seen some 0 days inside of exploit kits, but mostly they just keep track of every single CVE that's been released and come up with a very targeted way to get, you know, their malware on based on that. So if you're, you know, 1 day, 2 day, you know, 3 months out of date with Java or Flash, you're going to get owned. You're going to get compromised from visiting that web page. And that's a weird place to be, because not only do we have a lot of customers that have, I need to finish out the animation. There, I told you there were cat pictures. Thanks, Andrew. So not only are there a lot of customers who are out of date Java for a business reason, they've got some sort of mission critical time tracking software or something like that. That means that every single endpoint in their environment would be vulnerable anytime they touch one of these machines. And I've got a couple customers that this is just an ongoing adventure for them, because once a week they've got to, you know, let's format a bunch of machines again. And I'm like, or if you could move the application that runs Java off of your endpoints. And they're like, oh, that's cool, let's do that. But with the release cycle on these, is we're seeing some of the more resourced exploit kit authors. As soon as a 0 day is published, they're reverse engineering it, and they sometimes have it into the exploit kit before the patch is released. And even if the patch is released, they've got it, 6 hours sometimes it's in there. So even in really, really good IT organizations, it's pretty much impossible to get 100% patch compliance within 6 hours of something being released, especially as you get bigger and more global. So this is really something where we have to stop thinking necessarily just patch, although that's a big part of it, but starting to move into mitigation as well. because this is just, you know, visiting, you know, fully legitimate news website and somebody's getting infected with malware. And same thing, you know, it's not coming from an exploit kit, but this is the same sort of thing we've seen in targeted attacks as well, is they've compromised a web page and taken advantage of a flash zero day, which then does an elevation of privilege against the Win32k.sys driver in Windows. So that's not like ransomware. That's something that's taking a flash zero day and turning it into full system level access on your computer. So it's really important to think about, you know, mitigate as well as patch for these. So mitigation.
Sorry, I was muted. I'm trying to cut down on all the background noise.
I'm really like hoping that we hear something cool go past you, like maybe, you know, a parade or something.
Well, actually, so that's interesting that you said parade, because okay. I am on Colorado Boulevard, and this is actually the street that the Rose Bowl parade comes down.
Oh,
yeah.
Very cool.
So I'm in downtown Pasadena on Colorado Boulevard, and this is it. This is where it happens.
Excellent.
Right behind me.
I'm sure if I look out here, I could see Calgary, but I don't think that's going to happen right now.
There goes a bus.
Very cool. This is the most exciting episode of Taste of Premiere ever. You know, this definitely tops us talking about video games last time. But you know, this is really about how we can kind of stop people from just taking over your network and making money off of you, or doing far more targeted things. Because if we're thinking about, you know, attack of intellectual property or things like that, like I said, comes in through the exact same vulnerabilities, exact same ways in. So if you're looking around your network and you're seeing tons of ransomware cases, tons of things like that, that should be a little bit of a wake-up call that you've actually got a relatively large hole in your defense strategy. So number one, we do need to patch, right? You know, the unpatched third-party software, we've got a lot of places that have really, really out-of-date Flash, really, really out-of-date Java, and not always for a business mission-critical application reason. Sometimes it's just because patching isn't working, patching isn't a priority, or because of the fact that patching third-party software is really hard. We've made it really easy to patch Windows. There's Windows Update, there's SCCM, there's all these, there's WSUS, and that's actually had a ramification that Windows were hardly used at all last year in compromises. They were always going to be able to find something like a third-party application that they could compromise and then do an elevation of privilege. It wasn't really, really popular to use the Windows patches last year. And, you know, so, but it's not that easy to get, you know, your Flash and your Java into even SCCM, and certainly not WSUS. You've got to go to a third-party provider or, you know, spend some time packaging those things and getting them into SCCM. So this is part of the reason that we've got, you know, relatively good Windows Update patch compliance in some environments, but really, really bad update on Java and Flash. So this is something, you know, we can help with, but take a look in your environment and get real metrics, because sometimes we talk to customers and they've got like the report from the SCCM server, and then the security team runs a vulnerability scan and they're like, everything on this network is out of date. And it turns out they've got an underlying SCCM issue or vice versa. So make sure that you kind of validate from two sources what your true patch compliance is. Nobody's going to be perfect, but at least you can know. And, you know, maybe keep that third-party software that off of higher value machines. If you're, you know, not deploying privileged admin workstations for your domain admins, that's where we give them that special piece of hardware that we talked about in the SLAM offering and, you know, different things like that. If they're not having that, please at least uninstall Flash and Java so that when they browse the web, they don't have those sort of, you know, vulnerabilities on the higher value systems. And the other thing is that there are places that they have, you know, the application that makes them money, the application that runs their business, requires Java that might be, you know, 6 years old or something like that. I've seen that actually in a case. And that's bad because I need to do business, but I also don't want to go out of business. So there's a lot of things we can do to help out with those applications. The easiest one is something called Remote App. People don't seem to know much about this, but there's two different ways you can do Remote App. You can do Azure Remote App, where we actually host your application in the cloud, or you can actually just spin up a terminal server in your environment. And then in that terminal server, you could publish Remote App, and then just, it comes off as an MSI, so you can deploy, you know, out-of-date, insecure application X, through SCCM or whatever, and it actually runs as a terminal services remote desktop session. But then you can go the extra mile with group policies, firewall rules, proxy rules, things like that, and make sure that the only network location, the only Java location that that terminal server can reach is the one website that requires out-of-date Flash or Java. So it's not exposed to the massive internet, the Java is no longer installed on the endpoint, and the user doesn't really know the difference because there's going to be an icon on their desktop that says, you know, application, and they double-click on it, and that's how it works. So that's oftentimes the easiest thing for my customers to do, but there's a ton of other ways that we can do this. And I think both Kurt Faldo and I are going to blog about some of these options soon, so hopefully there'll be a link under here by the time this video gets released. The other thing is Emmet. I know that Kurt did a video about Emmet, but this is behavioral-based exploit prevention. So you can do two things with this. There's a feature called attack surface reduction, and attack surface reduction prevents certain plugins from even loading into an application. So if you have Emmet on your machine and you have the recommended settings, it's going to prevent Flash from loading out of PowerPoint, because we don't want you to do that anyway. It's actually not supported. There's probably no legitimate PowerPoint files out there loading Flash, and there's a lot of malicious PowerPoint files that are loading Flash. That was actually how a very targeted attack happened recently. So attack surface reduction, it can also let you block, you know, if you've got out-of-date Java in your environment, it can say don't load Java in Internet Explorer unless it's in the trusted site zone. So that's cool, because that can help out a lot with people who can't update. And then the other thing is it actually does those behavioral-based exploit prevention. So in order to get the malware on the box, frequently you have to perform some sort of memory corruption. A very famous one recently involved doing a heap spray attack. So a heap spray attack is a memory-based attack that is actually mitigated by Emmet. So having Emmet on these boxes can help out a ton with preventing a lot of these techniques there. And then the last one, I can't stress this enough. If you're a Premier customer, and I should have capitalized Premier there, sorry. If you're a Premier customer, when you get malware, open a case. We've got people that are trained on how to do this. They're going to take a look, they're going to dig through the forensic data, and they're going to figure out how that got there. So it's not a question of, was this a zero day, was this Java, was this a PDF, or whatever. We're going to say, nope, this came in, and potentially even we'll tell you the website. This came in from this place with this source at this time. You should probably patch that. Or, hey, could you want to talk to a PFE about, you know, mitigating this in some other way? So please utilize your Premier contract. I don't think enough people know that they have this as an option.
Well, I think it's awesome that you mentioned opening a Premier case, because that's really where customers need to start, especially if you're a Premier customer, right? And even if you don't have Premier support, most of you guys, or a lot of you guys out there, will have an enterprise license agreement. You get 24/7 support, and you can open a case via that mechanism as well. Opening a case, I think, is critical to resolving some of these issues.
Absolutely, because it's going to at least tell you where your vulnerabilities are in your environment. Because even, you know, a lot of places, even if they have assessments, if they're high maturity level, they may not realize they've got these, you know, hidden corners of their network where things aren't getting updated. Or they may be well aware that they have out-of-date Java, but not understand the implications of what it's doing. And a lot of times this is actually something where we can help out making the IT case for, you know, pushing a certain project or not. And we're Microsoft, we're not going to do that for you. But, you know, a lot of my customers have come in and they said, you know, I think I have a problem. How can I get the metrics on it? And we've helped them out by showing, look, this is how many cases you opened, you know, this is how much time you spend formatting systems, this is how much time it would take to put it into Azure remote app, you know, and you can kind of get better metrics. If you don't understand how it's happening, or if you've just got maybe a vague assumption of, oh, well, I guess my user did something wrong, it's not really allowing you to get that real view of your actual attack surface in your environment. So opening that Premier case, starting that conversation, figuring out how it got there, and then kind of running with that in your environment is entirely what a lot of places need to do.
And I think it's important to point out that, you know, we've said several times, and other companies have as well, I know that Apple is big on it, that, you know, Flash and Java, especially older versions of those technologies, do make your systems vulnerable, and this is an example of exactly how.
Yeah, I mean, it's not always Flash and Java that's the cause of this. I mean, I explained a couple other things there, but it is such a big problem that around summer of last year, we actually released a completely new GPO that I don't think anybody knows about or uses, but it's actually called Block Out of Date ActiveX on the Internet. There's an actual GPO built-in, free, group policy object because it is such a big problem. And it is, you know, it's not just Flash and Java. I mean, VGX.dll was a cause of some compromises, but you know, if you're running behind, it's always a problem. You know, get current, stay current. But running behind, when we're talking about the Flash threat landscape, is about 6 hours behind. So that's why it's so incredibly targeted all the time, is it's a very, very reliable way to get high privileged access on a system.
Yeah, it's good that you mentioned that. I can see the next big ransomware pop-up, right? Hey, there's a GPO in place that's preventing us from showing you this image. Contact your system administrator and have them. Yeah, that's going to be great. Also, I think it's important to mention that opening a Premier case doesn't necessarily mean that we'll be able to help you unencrypt the data that's encrypted.
Oh, we won't be able to. I think that's a great point to make, is we will not be able to get your data back. I'm very sorry. It's gone. And you know, we will help you figure out how it got there. But that's the other thing, is a lot of times people ask us, should I pay them and get my data back? Absolutely not. I do not recommend dealing with criminals. They're criminals. Remember, that's who you're paying. And it's interesting because they've had a pretty good track record of actually decrypting people's data. A couple of them have actually set up help desks. It's kind of cute. If you have problems getting a Bitcoin account or paying them, they'll actually help you out there. But you are paying criminals. And when you pay the criminal to unlock your system, you're not removing how it got there. And one of the vectors I didn't talk about here is that sometimes we're seeing the ransomware come in through downloaders, malware that's already been installed on a machine, you know, hanging out, doing maybe clickjacking, maybe doing keylogging, you know, malware that just sits there and gets other malware. And they realize that, you know, okay, well, I've made my $50 off of this person. Let's see if we can make some more. And they install or run the ransomware then. If you pay them their couple Bitcoin, you didn't remove the malware that's there. And that's a very important thing to think about, is that if you're paying the ransom, you're not removing the malware or the vulnerability. You might get your files back, but you're sending your money to criminals, and who knows if they're actually going to deal with you. So it's not really what we want you to do. We'd like you to think about your backup strategies before you go in, you know, and then get in contact with us and figure out how to stop it from happening again.
Awesome.
Yeah. So I think this is my last slide. So this is actually how we figure things out. This is actually stuff from the USN Change Journal of somebody that actually got infected. So when you think about all those, you know, glamorous television cybersecurity investigations, this is how boring it is. So we pull the USN Change Journal, which is the NTFS record of changes to the NTFS file system. It's a great forensic artifact. And then we start digging through CRUD, for lack of a better term. So this is a guy. We saw his temporary internet files. That JavaScript was actually the redirector to the exploit kit. We then saw a crash. We were able to see a crash going on there. A jump list was created for something that he was opening up, and then all the encryption files started to happen there. So we actually usually work backwards from there. So this is actually how we figure it out when we're digging through. This is a very abbreviated version. It's not all of the data, but that's how we can kind of connect through, you know, random system and, you know, maybe not even having the Internet Explorer history on it to, you know, hey, that's how you got infected. This is what happened there. So, and like I said, this is a random sort of configuration of different stuff here, but that's how we tell it when you open up a case with us.
Jessica, that was awesome.
Thank you. I hope it's helpful too, because I think, you know, I think it's something that not a lot of people are focusing on. You know, this is the boring stuff. This isn't, you know, the APT stuff. This isn't what, you know, malware researchers are onto the new thing. But this is so much affecting a lot of people still, and I think it's important to talk about how it relates to those more serious threats as well.
Well, I think it's anything but boring. And I promise everybody this is not scripted.
If it were, you wouldn't have heard buses in the background.
That's right. Absolutely. Yeah, this is definitely not scripted. In fact, if I tilt my camera down, you might be able to see across the street.
Very good.
See, there's all sorts of stuff back there. Yeah, I mean, that was awesome. And I think it is incredibly interesting just because of the, you know, the attack footprint that this has. I mean, it's very easy for people to get infected by this. It's very easy for, you know, this to affect an entire business or your grandmother, as we talked about earlier. And so I think it's incredibly interesting. Actually, I think it's one of the more interesting security episodes that we've done. So don't sell yourself short. I think it's awesome.
Well, if anybody goes to Ignite Australia, I'll be there, and they can ask me about it there, too. So,
awesome. Well, guys, it's been a very noisy episode, but absolutely a heck of a lot of fun. But here comes the bus, so I better hurry up. That's your Taste of Premiere. There's the bus. You can hear it, can't you?